furnishing water. The British countered by digging a well inside the fort, but it proved dry, and they began sending out at night blacks of deepest hue to carry water from a nearby stream. Next, Green tried tunneling toward the redoubt in an attempt to plant explosives under it. The Polish engineer and soldier, Thaddeus Kosciuszko, directed the excavations, but he started the twin tunnels too close to the fort. The defenders countered with an ingenious warning device, which consisted of a leather thong stretched from a lance stuck in the ground outside the redoubt to a drum that amplified vibrations in the earth. Listening to the drum skin, loyalists knew when to send snipers up to pin diggers in the tunnels like woodchucks. While the soldiers sniped, loyalist women inside the stockade fortified walls with sandbags made from their undergarments. For 28 days, the longest siege by the Continental Army, Green's troops tried to drive out the enemy. 200 and some men died, more from heat than guns, in the futile exchange. One minor casualty was Kosciuszko, who, a contemporary wrote, got shot in the seat of honor. In June, 2,000 British regulars moved toward 96 and Green withdrew. The fort never did fall, but Green's continual pressure in the upcountry forced the English to weaken their position at Charleston, and soon after the siege, they evacuated the Carolina Loyalists and abandoned both fort and stockaded town. Although the conflict at this last British outpost in the interior was a battle both sides won and lost, 4 months later the Redcoats relinquished everything at Yorktown. "We had some folks in from Nova Scotia," Durham said. "Their ancestors lived here before the British moved them to Canada. Most who come in come for specific reasons. They aren't just sightseeing. But once the government develops the area, it'll be another story. We'll get vacationers who go from national park to park and see scenery and other tourists." We came to a small lake. A man sat in the brush with a cane pole. "Fishing's illegal now," Durham said, "but he's probably been working the pond since it was built in the 40s. I couldn't tell the poor guy to clear out. A carp may be all he eats today. Old boys still slip around at night to string trot lines. It'll always be open county land to them." No one had come in when we returned to the cabin. "I'll show you the star fort." An odd-looking dog named Hector led the way into the woods. "He's been here longer than any of us, and he'll be here after we get transferred. If his nose was a brain, he'd be the expert on 96. The pines had dropped a sulfurous pollen over everything, and our boots exploded little yellow puffs. We crossed the Cherokee path. Eroded several feet into the earth, about 12 feet wide, the trail, in spite of trees and brush, was unmistakable. "That's it," he said. "Probably 1,000 years old. The Cherokee chief's old hop and hanging maw walked here. DeSoto, General George Chicken, millions of feet. The Park Service has plans for a visitor center and roads and more restoration. They've already brought in cannon replicas. If I managed the site, though, I'd leave it pretty much overgrown, like it's been for 200 years. Maybe clear the Cherokee path for hiking, and that would be it. I love the place too much to change it. But one day we'll have pavement, so high-heeled ladies and overweight men can tiptoe a few steps to the star fort, see something they don't understand, take a snapshot of themselves, and hurry on. Without trees and isolation, you lose the mystery." Beyond lay the redoubt. Under the oaks was a moat-like depression, surmounted by an eight-pointed mound. Trees grew from the rise and inside the earthworks. One even grew out of a concavity that had been the well the British had dug. Just north of the fort were angled banks and trenches, the freshly reconstructed Patriot siege works. The original mounds, piled up hastily, had soon fallen back into the ditches. Yet after all the years, the spirit of the place, its Newman, was strong. "Everything's so compressed," I said. "Firing at each other point-blank like this, how could Green dig trenches and tunnels?" "He built a rifle platform of logs so sharpshooters could keep the enemy ducking. But you're right about distance. They could have fought with mud balls and slingshots. There's a novel by Kenneth Roberts called Oliver Wiswell that describes the siege. Fascinating, especially because it takes the loyalist view. A man limped out of the woods. He once lived nearby and had returned for a look. He asked Durham what had happened to the tunnels. "We filled in the entrances for safety, but they're still here. You're standing over one."
"We used to fool in them tunnels when we was kids," the man said. "I'll tell you, this land's seen some times. Cockfights, even a duel inside the fort."
He gave a broken smile.
"I'll tell you boys something else. They was some girls who got their panties took off in them tunnels,"
Durham said quietly to me, history speaking. A woman joined the man and asked whether he'd found what he was looking for. He nodded. As they strolled off, he said,
"They was mischief out here, honey."
He looked excited. "I'm glad Kosciuszko's tunneling didn't go for naught. That's our kind of visitor, ones who remember 96 from before, or history buffs who come out to mentally reconstruct the battle. They give a better tour than I do. We get 1,000 folks a year now, but when the site's developed, they estimate we'll have 50,000. 20 years ago, all the national parks took in 70 million people. Now it's about 300 million. 96 will have to be standardized, won't be allowed off the walks. Tell them to leave it alone. Not possible. Not now that it's in federal hands. Some of the work the government's done here is good, though. Archaeologists have excavated and found the locations of the jail and courthouse inside the stockade. They found several bivouac areas with magnetometers that detect acid in the soil from old latrines. Infrared aerial surveys have revealed a lot. We know more about 96 than we did 2 years ago, and they've uncovered so many relics, we'll never be able to display them all at once. The heat was up when we hiked back, and it was bringing out copperheads. Watching the trail, I saw something on the ground, a nugget of melted glass. "Probably an old bottle," Durham said. "One guy's found a uniform button from every regiment that served here, just by scuffling his feet. Now it's illegal to take anything off the site." Durham told about a man in the 18th century who lived nearby and wrote an account of the local Indians to prove they descended from a lost tribe of Israel. A crazy book, but his descriptions of their life saved crucial details of history from disappearing. "What about 96? Will it disappear now that it's being opened?" "For a couple hundred years," he said, "it's been cared for by people of the county through a sort of benign neglect. They used it, but they knew what had happened here and didn't disturb it much, except to pick up souvenirs when they came across one. The houses are full of tomahawks and powder horns. Somebody even found a cannon in the woods years ago. But they loved the place. A guy wrote a letter in 1850 and said people here considered the trees and bushes of the battleground too sacred to be molested." That's his word, molested. But who knows about the service? The boss says, and he's been with the Interior Department 20 years, that if the feds ever need NPS land for another purpose, timber, mining, you can bet it will go. Maybe it's gone already, then. Could be. But to a historian, it's been going since the beginning. 16. In the land of Coca-Cola, it was hot and dry. The artesian water was finished. Along Route 72, an hour west of 96, I tried not to look for a spring. I knew I wouldn't find one, but I kept looking. The Savannah River, dammed to an unnatural wideness, lay below, wet and cool. I'd come into Georgia. The sun seemed to press on the roadway, and inside the truck, hot light bounced off chrome, flickering like a torch. Then I saw what I was trying not to look for. In a coppice, a long-handled pump. I stopped and took my bottles to the well. A small sign. Water unsafe for drinking. I drooped like warm tallow. What fungicide, herbicide, nematicide, fumigant, or growth regulant, potions that rebuilt southern agriculture, had seeped into the groundwater? In the old movie westerns, there is commonly a scene where a dehydrated man, crossing the barren waste, at last comes to a water hole. He lies flat to drink the tepid stuff. Just as lips touch water, he sees on the other side a steer skull,
I drove off thirsty, but feeling a part of mythic history. The thirst subsided when hunger took over. I hadn't eaten since morning. Sunset arrived west of Oglesby, and the air cooled. Then a road sign. Swamp Guinea's Fish Lodge, all you can eat. An arrow pointed down a county highway. I would gorge myself. A record would be set. They'd ask me to leave, an embarrassment to all. The road through the orange earth of North Georgia passed an old three-story house with a thin black child hanging out of every window, like an illustration for the old woman who lived in a shoe. On into hills, and finally to Swamp Guinea's, a conglomerate of plywood and two-by-fours laid over with the smell of damp pine woods. Inside, wherever an oddity or natural phenomenon could hang, one hung. Stuffed rump of a deer, snowshoe, flintlock, hornet's nest. The place looked as if a Boy Scout troop had decorated it. 30 or so people, black and white, sat around tables almost foundering under piled platters of food. I took a seat by the reproduction of a 17th century woodcut depicting some Rabelaisian banquet at the groaning board. The diners were mostly Oglethorpe County red dirt farmers. In Georgia tones, they talked about their husbandry in terms of rain and nitrogen and hope. An immense woman, with a glossy picture of a hooked bass leaping the front of her shirt, said, "I'm gonna be sick from how much I've ate." I was watching everyone else and didn't see the waitress standing quietly by. Her voice was deep and soft, like water moving in a cavern. I ordered the $4.50 special. In a few minutes, she wheeled up a cart and began offloading dinner. Ham and eggs, fried catfish, fried perch fingerlings, fried shrimp, chunks of barbecued beef, fried chicken, French fries, hush puppies, a broad bowl of coleslaw, another of lemon, a quart of iced tea, a quart of ice, and an entire loaf of factory-wrapped white bread. The table was covered. "Call me if y'all want any more." She wasn't joking. I quenched the thirst and then, slowly, went to the eating. I had to stand to reach plates across the table, but I intended to do the supper in. It was all southern fried and good, except the southern-style sweetened iced tea. Still, I took care of a quart of it. As I ate, making up for meals lost, the old woman in the shoe house flashed before me, lightning in darkness. I had no moral right to eat so much. But I did. Headline, "Stomach Pump Fails to Revive Traveler." The loaf of bread lay unopened when I finally abandoned the meal. At the register, I paid a man who looked as if he'd been chipped out of Georgia Chert, the Swamp Guinea. I asked about the name. He spoke of himself in the third person, like the Wizard of Oz. "The Swamp Guinea only tells regulars." "I'd be one, Mr. Guinea, if I didn't live in Missouri." "Y'all from the north?" "Here, I got something for you." He went to the office and returned with a 45 RPM record. "It's my daughter singing. A little promotion we did. Take it along." Later, I heard a husky North Georgia voice let go a down-home lyric rendering of Swamp Guinea's menu. "That's all you can eat for $1.50. Hey, the barbecue's nifty." And so on, through the fried chicken and potatoes. As I left, the Swamp Guinea, a former antique dealer whose name was Rudell Burroughs, said, "The nickname don't mean anything. Just made it up. Tried to figure a good one so we can franchise someday." The frogs, high and low, shrilled and bellowed from the trees and ponds. It was cool going into Athens, a city suffering from a nasty case of the sprawls. On the University of Georgia campus, I tried to walk down Swamp Guinea's supper. Everywhere, couples entwined like moonflower vines, each waiting for the blossom that opens only once. 17. The Baptists have a way with church names in the South. The road out of Athens went past Baby Farms Church, and in the last several days I'd seen Baptist churches called Sinking Creek, Little Doe, Sweet Home. Along the blue highways, I saw a few churches that could have been banks. First Church of whatever, United Church of so-and-so, or athletic stadiums, Memorial Park Church of the etc. That morning, down on Route 20, near Conyers, Georgia, while I ate breakfast in the Smyrna Presbyterian Church Cemetery, I read the Scotch-Irish names on tombstones and listened to the radio. A stained glass voice beating repentance into the ungraced at 95.6 megahertz a second may have influenced what happened next. Again on the road, I noticed an old-style water tower, the kind on stilts with a conical lid, topped by a cross. Even in the Bible Belt, that was out of place. Then I saw the tank stood on the grounds of the Monastery of the Holy Spirit. I turned up the drive of Magnolias. Built into a high wall, off the arched gateway, was a small bookshop. And there were books inside, but also jams and jellies, bread, sand castings, window hangings, religious pictures, rosaries, and plaques saying, "Have you not seen him in the things he has made?" A monk, about 60, in the white tunic and black scapular of the Trappist, watched me open the seven-story mountain, the autobiography of the Trappist father Thomas Merton. Years ago, I had started it only to put it down.
"That's one you should read," he said in a voice like a truck in low gear.
"Did you ever meet Merton?"
"Meet Merton?"
The tone was both raw and humorous, rough and inviting.
"I knew Merton. I started out at the monastery in Gethsemane, Kentucky, where Merton wrote that book. I came from there in 1947 to help build this place out of pasture and woods. We put up everything you see except the old barn. That was here. We built as we could. Did the work ourselves with only a little help in architecture and circuitry."
"Were you a carpenter or tradesman of some kind?"
"Tradesman. That's it. I traded stock on Wall Street for 20 years.
That meant he had to be nearly 80. He seemed a character out of Lost Horizon. "Why did you give up Wall Street to become a monk?" He cleared his throat and shifted down.
"Look, talking about the spiritual life is a lot of crap. You just live it."
Idling tourists must have pestered him with that question for 30 years. I felt simple and abashed.
"Why don't you go inside to the retreat house and tell the guest master to invite you to lunch? You can ask your question in there."
"Lunch?" I had thought the gates demarked a forbidden ground where the secret and medieval life went on.
"Go tell him. He's Father Francis. Through the gate, follow the walk."
"Lunch?
What's your name, lad?"
I almost said lunch, but I got it right. He said,
"My name used to be Bill."
"Used to be." It sounded strange, as if he'd said, "I used to be a Bill, too." Later, I learned that was just what he did mean. All the monks used to be someone else.
"I'm Brother Pius now."
So I went through to the other side of the stone walls. Pius? What was wrong with Brother Bill? I felt guilty. I was here out of curiosity, a spiritual voyeur, an ecclesiastical window peeper. What's more, such cloistered spirituality made me suspicious, dubious about men who sought changelessness to release them from uncertainty and turmoil. I question a faith that has to be protected by illusory immutability. Intimidated by ignorance of Trappist beliefs, I was uneasy about what I imagined went on in a monastery. I mean, I've read Chaucer. Monasteries, I knew, were remnants from the Dark Ages, dying vestiges of medievalism, and monks were religious atavisms. Why would a sane man sequester himself, renounce the world? How could he serve a religion that makes so much of love among peoples and then keep to himself? Still, I wanted to see the strange rites that must occur inside. But why would they let me in? I found the retreat lodge. A man, small and gray, moving up and down the halls, disappeared in one door, hurried out another, popped up here, then vanished again, like Alice's Wonderland rabbit. Somehow he came up behind me. He spoke the way he moved, dartingly. "Are you here for lunch?"
"I'd like to be."
"Yes, yes, fine. That's fine. Yes." He scurried away a few steps, then scurried back. "There's a reading room. Make yourself comfortable. I've got to tell the cook you'll be with us. That's fine." He was through the door, down the hall. On a desk, I saw a flyer that said, "Come aside for a while." Aside. In the reading room, there was only a single shelf of worn books, but I found the Merton and took it to a balcony overlooking a small enclosed garden. Quiet and cool. No voices, no steps. Nothing but a towhee in the bush, whistling a one-note monotony. Aside. I sat and stared into the trees, the book open across my legs. The monks had spoken as if they had met me long ago. As if I'd said years back, "I'll be there someday, don't wait up." I began reading The Seven-Story Mountain. Here is Merton's response to his first visit to a Trappist monastery. The logic of the Cistercian life was then the complete opposite to the logic of the world, in which men put themselves forward so that the most excellent is the one who stands out, the one who is eminent above the rest, who attracts attention. But what was the answer to this paradox? Simply that the monk, in hiding himself from the world, becomes not less than himself, not less of a person, but more of a person, more truly and perfectly himself. For this personality and individuality are perfected in their true order, and the spiritual interior order of union with God, the principle of all perfection. The passage brought something back, something from long ago. Three times I had seen Heat Moon disappear when he sought the deepest union. Here was no Whitman celebrating himself, finding no sweeter fat than what sticks to his own bones. An hour later, Brother Francis called me to lunch. The meal was a strange combination of monastic spareness and a little league picnic. On a plain white plate, boiled cabbage, a boiled potato, figs, rye bread, and hot dog, raspberry Kool-Aid to drink. No second helpings. Swamp Guineas was a world away. I was the only non-Catholic at the table of four other guests and three monks. While the conversation rambled over papal encyclicals and the chances of the Atlanta Braves, I watched the monks closely, knowing they might talk a good ball game, but sooner or later they would betray their medievalism by lapsing into Latin or intoning a prayer. All I had to do was watch. They would try to root the heresy out of me or sell an indulgence, but they ate their hot dogs with ketchup or mustard, and their lips turned Kool-Aid blue, just like mine. Then, as if to a tolling only they heard, they rose and disappeared, the other guests with them. Alone again. On the balcony, I read more Merton until Father Anthony DeLisi, a man with a dark Latin face, asked if I'd like to see the monastery. As we walked, he answered novice questions about the order. Cistercians, trying to return to a basic simplicity, separated from the Benedictine order in 1098. In 1664, the Trappists, wishing to move even closer to pure necessity and unadorned worship, formed a suborder within the Cistercians. The monastery grounds and buildings showed the Trappist desire for directness in the clarity of line, the openness, and the unclutter. It reminded me of the Shaker Village. The buildings were concrete with touches of brick, stone, and unfinished wood. Everything free of decoration, except the geometry of stained glass in the chapel. "Some find our place austere," Father Anthony said. "Then I'll take austerity. The purpose is freedom, for body and mind. Simplicity is flexible. It endures well. Without so many things around, we have more time." He showed the subsistence industries, raising black Angus, growing hay and vegetables and houseplants and bonsai, baking bread. Recently, the brothers had started fabricating stained glass windows for churches and synagogues after monks learned the craft while constructing windows for their own sanctuary. The brothers do all the work without any help from outside? Almost. The majority practice a trade as part of the daily routine. Of course, the spiritual life is our real work. But we have to have bakers and plumbers and hay cutters. We get up at 3:45 and go to bed at 8:30. In between, we attend services, eat, and spend 4 hours a day at manual labor, and still take time for the hardest work, reflection. I thought Trappist life was exceedingly strict, severe, you might say, You can see we're not disco priests on the streets. But some restrictions have eased. When I first came, we lived under the rule of silence and spoke only through sign language.
Which one?
I know some signs of the Plains Indians. I've forgotten most of it now. Words I remember are pictorial signs. Here, what am I saying? His right fingers wiggled over his left palm.
Run up the hill and get a pail of water?
No, no. The dog chased the cat into the church.
I think you misspelled dog. It has four thumb wiggles, not two.
Any complexity of thought, I take it, had to occur between man and God, rather than between monks.
Maybe.
But you just don't talk as much if you have to use fingers. We don't waste words today. In the refectory, for instance, we still observe, to a degree, a monastic silence. But now, as we eat, a brother will read to us. Scripture and biblical commentary, things like the Holy Fathers. We just finished Nicholas and Alexandra. We began understanding media not long ago, but voted it out. We vote on books to be read, then vote again one-third and two-thirds of the way through to see if we're interested in continuing. Had trouble understanding McLuhan. As we walked the grounds, Father Anthony introduced the monks. They were friendly in a plain and open manner, unsanctimonious, and not outwardly pious. They did not, as Whitman says, make me sick discussing their duty to God. Neither were they, to use Merton's word, disinfected men. Yet the older ones appeared a decade or more younger than men of their ages I was accustomed to seeing. Twisted or hanging faces were few, and I must say there was a life, a spirit, in the old who moved slowly. I realized I was trying to catch in their faces something I wouldn't see outside the walls, something hidden, transcendental, even mystical. But I noticed only a quietude, and I felt that more than saw it. I asked to see a dormitory. He didn't answer immediately. Instead, he picked up a leaf and twirled it. Nothing's secret about the rooms, but some brothers don't want disturbance. The opportunity for uninterrupted devotion and reflection is the reason many come here. Monastic means living alone. He was almost apologetic. The brothers you've met are ones whose duties put them before visitors, but others prefer solitude. One lives alone in the woods. It's his choice. The few still keep the rule of silence. You must understand the importance of quiet to us. A noisy man doesn't hear God? I wouldn't presume to answer that. There is something else, then. Something I'd like, if it's permitted. We don't copy manuscripts by hand. I know. You've got a brother who repairs Xerox machines. No, that's not it. I'd like to talk with a brother about why he became a monk. You must get tired of the question, but still, I'd like to ask again. Are you staying the night? Never crossed my mind. After dinner, I'll try to send someone around. Won't be easy. The evening meal was vegetable soup, peas, rice, bread, vanilla pudding. Again, just enough. At the table, talk turned toward a Savannah visitor recuperating from a coronary bypass who had come to see his novitiate son. Although the conversation was alternately serious and jocular, the man's quiet presence, the impending farewell between father and son, touched us all. Once more, the silent tolling. This time I rose with him. Father Anthony asked me to join him at Vespers. On the way to the chapel, we didn't talk. I think he was preparing. I remembered my denim and suspenders, my clothes, I said. He didn't break stride or turn his head. How could that matter? But singing on key does, can you? Never could. Don't sing loud, then. God doesn't mind. I do. The monks filed noiselessly into the great open sanctum and sat facing each other from both sides of the choir. At a signal I didn't perceive, they all stood to begin the antiphonal chanting of plainsong. Only younger ones and I looked at the hymnals. The 65 monks filled the church with a fine and deep tone of the Cantus Planus, and the setting sun warmed the stained glass. It could have been the year 1278. I looked at the faces. Quietude. What burned in those men that didn't burn in me? The difference of focus or something outside me? A lack or too much of something? To my right, a monk sat transfixed, eyes unblinking, and his lips, the tiniest I'd ever seen on a man, never moved. I thought if I could know where he was, then I would know this place. There was nothing but song and silences. No sermon, no promise of salvation, no threat of damnation, no exhortation to better conduct. I'm not an authority, God knows, but if there is a way to talk into the great primal ears, if ears there be, music and silence must be the best way. Afterwards, I returned to the balcony. Empty but for the sounds of dusk coming on, tree frogs, whippoorwills, crickets. I've read that Hindus count 330 million gods. Their point isn't the accuracy of the count, but rather the multiplicity of the Godhead. That night, if you listened, it seemed everywhere. I sat staring and felt strong upon me, as Whitman has it, the life that does not exhibit itself. Someone behind, someone tall, said my name. 18. He used to be Patrolman Patrick Duffy. Now he was usually just Brother Patrick. A name didn't count for much anyway. Angular, sinewy, red beard, shaved head, white tunic. Distinctly medieval, in spite of the waffle-soled hiking boots. About him was an unacademic, unpietistic energy, the kind that the men who made Christianity must have possessed. Quite capable of driving snakes out of Ireland, or anywhere else, for that matter. "I hear you have questions," he said. None of the usual feeling out before a conversation on a sensitive topic begins. A frontal assault, man. I picked it up. "Tell me why a man becomes a Trappist monk. Answers I heard today sounded like catechism recited 1,000 times. "It isn't an easy question, or at least the answer isn't easy. Tell me how it happened to you, how you got here." "I've been here 5 years. I was a policeman in Brooklyn, Bedford-Stuyvesant, on my way to becoming a ghetto cop. Did it for 7 years. Before that, I was an army medic, attended St. Francis College part-time, and worked in the Brooklyn Public Library. An education has come in other ways, too. I hitched around the country in 1957 and again in 58. Went to Central America on the second trip and spent time in Honduras. Jack Kerouac on the road? Something like that. I came back to New York and worked as a sandhog digging subway tunnels in Manhattan. Then I got Siemens papers to go into the Merchant Marine. Listen, papers are hard to come by. I had to scramble to get them. Then I never used them. Why not? Got interested in police work, but I was still unsettled and afraid of getting stuck in a ship, afraid of drudgery. I like changes. Changes? In here? Of all you could find here, I'd think change would be the least likely. I mean growth and a change of pace. I work 4 hours as an electrician's assistant. Watch out, this is going to be philosophical. But you can make some kind of analogy between being an electrician and a monk. The flow of energy from a greater source to smaller outlets. Still, the electrical work is different from the spiritual work, even if I try to merge them. Two things don't seem like much change. I'm also what you might describe as the monastery forest ranger. They call me Smokey the Monk. I oversee the wooded part of the grounds, try to keep the forest healthy. Just for fun, I've been cataloging all the wildflowers here. We've identified about 200 species, not counting the blue unknowns and pink mysteries. Working on shrubs now. And I've taken to birdwatching since I came. I spend a lot of time in the woods, reading, thinking. That's when real changes can happen. What do you read? In the woods, some natural history, some Thoreau, always scripture and theology. Reading about the charismatic movement now. He was silent a moment. Does any of this explain why I'm here? It all must be part of an answer. For years, I've been fascinated by intense spiritual experiences of one kind or another. When I was 17, I'm 42 now, I thought about becoming a monk. I'm not sure why, other than to say I felt an incompleteness in myself. But after a while, the desire seemed to disappear. That's when I started traveling. I learned to travel, then traveled to learn. Later, when I was riding a radio car in Brooklyn, I began to want a life and morality based not so much on constraint, but on aspiration toward a deeper spiritual life. Damn, that was unsettling. I thought about seeing a psychiatrist, but after a couple of months, I just stopped worrying whether I was crazy. What happened? I'm not sure. Maybe I got cured when I started working part-time with the Franciscans in New York. They do a lot of community work at the street level, and that gave me a chance to look into this monkey business, as a friend calls it. I joined the Franciscans Third Order for 2 years to test whether I really wanted to enter a monastery, although their work is secular rather than monastic. Then I worked with the Little Brothers of the Gospel. They live communally in stark simplicity in the Bowery. That helped make up my mind. I liked what I could see of a religious life. I began to see my problem was not trusting myself, being afraid of what I really wanted. He pulled up his tunic and scratched his leg. Understand, there was nothing wrong with riding a radio car, although I got tired of the bleeding and the shot and cut people I was bandaging up. Seemed I was a medic again, and delivering babies in police car back seats, 13 of those. The poor tend to wait to the last minute, then they call the police. He stopped. Forgot what I was talking about. Trusting yourself. Better to say a lack of self-trust. As a kid, I was always searching for something beyond myself, something to bring harmony and make sense of things. Whatever my understanding of that something is, I think it began in the cop work and even more when I was assisting the friars in New York. I was moving away from things and myself toward concerns bigger than me and my problems. But I didn't really find a harmony until I came here. I don't mean to imply I have total and everlasting harmony. I'm just saying I feel it more here than in other places. He was quiet for some time. Tonight I can give you 10 reasons why I'm a monk. Tomorrow, I might see 10 new ones. I don't have a single unchanging answer. Hope that doesn't disappoint you. Try it in terms of what you like about the life here. I've always been attracted to hermetic living. I didn't say hermetic living. But only for short periods. I go off in the woods alone, but I come back. Here, nobody asks, what happened to you? You off the beam again? Living behind that front wall, it doesn't surround us, by the way. Living here doesn't mean getting sealed off. This is no vacuum. We had a new kid come in. He left before he took his vows because he couldn't find so-called stability. Stability meaning no change. I told him this place was alive. People grow here. The brothers are likely to start sprouting leaves and blossoms. This is no place to escape from what you are, because you're still yourself. In fact, personal problems are prone to get bigger here. Our close community and reflective life tend to magnify them. How did you finally make the decision to come aside? A friend's father told me, if you don't do what you want when you're young, you'll never do it. So I quit waiting for certainty to come. A 5-year experiment. Was it the right thing? Right? It's one of the right things. The best right thing. I believe in it enough, I'm taking my permanent vows in October. You don't have second thoughts? Second, third, fourth. I go with as much as I can understand. And I've gotten little signs, like listening to Beethoven. I loved Beethoven. Been here 2 years, and one day I just went over and turned the stereo off. Beethoven was too complex, I guess, for me. My tastes have developed toward simpler things. Merton calls it the grace of simplicity. I haven't broken myself of Vivaldi, though. I wanted to ask a question, but it seemed out of bounds. I decided to anyway. I'd like to know something, partly out of curiosity and partly out of trying to imagine myself a monk. He didn't laugh, but I did. My question, let's see. I guess I want to know how you endure without women.
I don't endure it. I choose it.
He was silent again. Sometimes, when I'm doing my smoky duties, I come across a couple picnicking, fooling around. Whenever that happens, when I'm reminded where I've been, I sink a little. I feel an emptiness. Not for a woman so much as for a child. I would like to have had a son. That's the emptiness. What do you do? His answers were coming slowly. I try to take desires and memories of companionship, destructive ones, and let them run their course. Wait it out. Don't panic. That's when the emptiness is intense. And that's it? That's the beginning. Then I turn the pain of absence into an offering to God. Sometimes that's all I have to offer. You mean what you've given up? Does it seem like I'm giving nothing? It seems like a gift of giving up a gift. For he so loved God, he gave up his only unbegotten son. Brother Patrick smiled. Just say I try to turn the potential for destructiveness into a useful force. In that way, the attraction of the outside reinforces. It's another way to come closer to God. Someone else today used that phrase about coming closer to God. It sounds like the Hindus who renounce the world and move away from things, including their own desires, so they can get closer to their God. Simplicity reveals the universals we all live under. Material goods can blunt your perception of greater things. Here, the effort is to free yourself from blindness, arrogance, selfishness. The bells rang for Compline. It was so dark, I heard Duffy more than I saw him. He said, I begin with this broken truth that I am. I start from the entire broken man, entire but not whole. Then I work to become empty and whole. In looking for ways to God, I find parts of myself coming together. In that union, I find a regeneration. Sounds like spiritual biology. Why not? After a pause, he said, coming here is following a call to be quiet. When I go quiet, I stop hearing myself and start hearing the world outside me. Then I hear something very great.
Part 3. South by Southeast. 1. Amidst a clangor of bells in the middle of the night, the brothers began their day. I heard shuffling along the walks as they went to morning prayers. Admiring men who can give thanks for a day still 2 hours from first light, I again burrowed down into the bed in deep sloth. After breakfast, I put my duffel together, left a contribution, and shook hands with a surprising number of people before going back through the big gate. When I stepped into my rig, I thought for a moment I was in the wrong truck. It seemed small and enclosed, like a cell. Not a monk's cell, but a prisoner's. Even simple and necessary gear looked foreign. Dross. On Georgia 155, I crossed Troublesome Creek, then went through groves of pecan trees, aligned one with the next like fence posts. The pastures grew a green, almost blue, and syrupy water the color of a dusty sunset filled the ponds. Around the farmhouses, from wires strung high above the ground, swayed gourds, hollowed out for purple martens. The land rose again on the other side of the Chattahoochee River, and Highway 34 went to the ridgetops where long views over the hills opened in all directions. Here was the tail of the Appalachian backbone, its gradual descent to the Gulf. Near the Alabama state line stood a couple of last chance bars, those desperate places that run at a higher pitch than taverns, part of the whole fabric of a town. There's an unnaturalness in them, isolated as they usually are from the ordinary circuits of people. On into Tallapoosa County and Alexander City, just north of our town.
where I found a place for the night by the tennis courts of the community college. That evening was to change the direction of the journey. 2. The woman was an authority. Whatever there was, she knew it. Her face, pallid like a partly boiled potato, looked as if carved out with a paring knife. She was a matron of note in Alexander City. Two other women, dark and 18-hole tans, sat with her on a bench alongside the tennis courts, while their daughters took lessons under the lights. The discussion on the bench was Tupperware. The potato had just said, "For a shower gift, you can't do better than pack and store." Another explained how her eldest had received an upright freezer full of nesting food containers from the Walkers.
"That reminds me," said the third woman. "How is Mildred?"
"How good can you be, taking cobalt?" the authority answered.
A daughter, in pearl mint lip gloss, jogged up to a handsome man standing by the courts. On his shirt, a famous little crocodile was laughing at something. Her damp halter top and tennis shorts clung to her like tattoos. She didn't mind my staring.
"Buy me a cola drink, Daddy."
A sunburned man at the end of the bench said, "Doesn't she get her share of the attention? Goes to school in the north. Nobody here can touch her." "North, south," I said. "Makes no difference." He said nothing. The girls returned to their lessons. The father went back to courtside, and the women talked about above-ground swimming pools. The sunburned fellow muttered, "That your green van?" I nodded and told him I was looking around the south. He asked, "You go through Atlanta?" "Trying to stay out of cities. Not seeing the south then. Better go back." He moved down the bench. I smelled booze. "I went to Emory University for 5 years. Drove a city bus in Atlanta to pay for my schooling." As he rambled, I watched the players chase tennis balls. He said something about a martyr bus. "What's a martyr bus?" "M-A-R-T-A. Metropolitan Atlanta Rapid Transit Authority, otherwise known as Moving Africans Rapidly Through Atlanta." "I don't get it." "The blacks, you know, the domestics living in Buttermilk Bottom, the goddamn ghetto. They take buses to the suburbs to clean houses." "I see." "No, you don't. You're goggling the co-eds in their cute tans. Listen, church in Atlanta, down on West Peachtree, had a signboard, big letters, where the folks are friendly. Same church that wouldn't let a black preacher speak at a worldwide Methodist conference." Nothing particularly southern about that. He wasn't listening. He was convincing me. "I can tell you about a boutique in underground Atlanta that sold little plastic axe handles signed by a former governor. Even being a Yankee, you might have heard of Lester Maddox taking a stand in front of his Pick Rick restaurant with a goddamn axe handle in his goddamn hands. I mean, he got elected governor because he got photographed with a goddamn axe handle. I wasn't with Martyr then, but if I'd have been, I'd have driven my bus right into Lester's fucking cream pies." The blue crocodile man turned to us. He said, "Easy, Marlin. Ladies about. We've heard all that stuff by now. Times have changed for ideas like that." "Changed?" He looked at the tall man. "I'll tell you, change." He turned to me, his sunburn reddening. "Here's change. A monument to the boll weevil in Enterprise, Alabama, because it broke King Cotton's back so beans and corn could take over. Here's change. Atlanta Klan rally. Klan as in Ku fucking Klux, year or two ago. Little ad in the Constitution advertising the rally. At the bottom it says, 'Bring your own robe.' Organization changed from furnishing the stinking bed sheets." Looking at me, the handsome man put his hand on Marlin's shoulder. "You're the one needs changing, Marlin. Next thing you'll be spouting again about your great-granddaddy up in the quarry at Sylacauga, cutting marble for the Supreme Court building. Hear yourself. It's all old talk now." To me, Marlin said, "I drove a bus, and he drives a real estate office. You figure it out, Yankee." He got up, knocked the man's hand from his shoulder, and put his face close to mine. In a mocking, gone-with-the-wind accent, he said, "Why don't y'all get your fucking eyes off the darling Bell's butts and go over to Selma? see what Uncle Remus got to say since he done give up the cakewalk. He went off up the hill. That was it. 3. By mid-morning, I was following Route 22, as I had from the Alabama line, on my way to Selma. The truck license plates said Heart of Dixie, and I was going into the middle of the heart. West of the bouldery Coosa River, I saw an old man plowing an old field with an old horse, and once more I wasn't sure whether I was seeing the end or beginning. Then an outbreak of waving happened, first at Maplesville, again in Stanton, again in Plantersville. From galleries and sidewalks, people waved, where folks are friendly. It was late afternoon in Selma, and big trees along Broad Street, a clean and orderly avenue, shaded the way. Citizens swept porches and talked over hedges. At the bottom of Broad, the Edmund Pettus Bridge arched high above the Alabama River. The span, named after a Confederate private who mustered out as a brigadier general, was the point where mounted troopers forced a halt to Martin Luther King's first attempt to march to Montgomery. But the afternoon I saw the bridge, it looked silvery and quiet, more ordinary than historic. Water Avenue intersected Broad Street and ran parallel to the river on the high north side. West on the avenue was a boarded-up building of Doric columns and an inscription chiseled in stone, Harmony Club. East stood two- and three-story brick buildings, with ornamental ironwork supporting galleries that gave the street an aspect of the Vieux Carré in New Orleans. What little remained of Selma's old commercial architecture, buildings Walker Evans photographed during the Depression, was here. I looked along Broad Street for a beer to chase the heat and furnish opportunity for conversation. Two places appeared to be bars, but signs outside gave no indication. Water Avenue, down where Confederate shipfitters had built ironclads to fight Farragut at Mobile Bay, was quiet but for an old cotton warehouse with a buzzing electric sign, Mickey's Place. A second sign above showed a champagne glass, a plus symbol, and a human figure either dancing or falling over dead. Mickey's was, in fact, a tavern, and the sign a Bible Belt hieroglyphic to say that. I was the only customer. The barmaid, in her early 20s, wore a see-through blouse that surrendered transparency at the last possible point of decency. At the center, she had pinned a made-in-Taiwan red plastic rose, which matched another stuck into a pair of black lace underpants nailed to the wall. She stood looking forlorn, I thought, twisting a highball glass on stacks of joke napkins, turning them into little cigarettes. In the dimness, the bar mirror, only a few feet away, returned no reflection, and I checked to see if I had on sunglasses. I didn't, but she wore hers. Perfume stuck to the wet bottle of beer she set down. "What's with the sign outside?" I said. Wasn't sure this was a bar. "Can't advertise bars or liquor in the city. About the most you can get away with is cold beverages of all kinds." 4 new, antiqued Pabst Blue Ribbon wall lamps behind the bar were mounted upside down, with the name smeared over. "What's with the lights?"
"That's advertising."
"I can read Pabst on the bottle in my hand, but not on the wall."
"You catch on fast." "Where are you from?"
"Chicago." I told her. She took off her sunglasses to get or give a better look, then put them on again when a man came in for a bottle of beer to go. She rolled it carefully in a paper sack, but the outline was unmistakable. It looked like a little mummy. "Where are you from?"
"Right here," she said. "Selma, ever-loving Ella, goddamn Bama. Heart of D-I-X-I-E.
I smiled.
"Don't laugh, Chicago. Here's the only place I ever been, except in Montgomery, and Biloxi once as a baby. But I'm heading for New Orleans soon. This little number is on the move. Look away, Dixieland."
She removed her sunglasses.
"So, what's Mr. Chicago doing in Selma?"
"Mr. Chicago was encouraged to come to see what the march changed."
"What march?"
"King's March." She lowered her voice.
"Touchy shit, Chicago. You're 2 blocks from Brown's Chapel. That's where it all started."
"Still touchy?
How long's it been?
Don't know. I was just a little kid.
Do blacks come in here now?
Here? They got their clubs, we got ours.
Doesn't sound like much has changed.
She turned to a sharp-edged man who had just sat down. He loudly said,
"Can I get me a Tom and Collins, or is lollygagging all that gets done in here?"
She mixed his drink and talked with him. Every so often he turned on me, his small, round eyes. She walked back up the bar.
13 years ago, Ray says the march was. Want another?
Sure, if you mean a beer.
Why don't you talk to Ray? He saw it both times.
Ray doesn't look like the chummy sort.
He's all right, usually. I can't tell you anything.
She looked down the bar.
Hey, Ray, I was telling Chicago about that night those dudes came in here and saw there wasn't any of their kind and left.
So?
So, like he wanted to know if things changed.
Ray, a jagged man, sat down beside me and looked hard at the woman. He said,
"As it is concerned."
Still talking to her, he turned to me and in my face opened a smile like a jackknife.
"All these northern boys want to know is, how's your nigger problem? Don't they think we get sick of that? Won't they let us rest? Ain't they got nothing new to say?"
I got accused last night of ignoring it.
"Okay, Sonny Jim, I'll tell you about change."
It came out like a threat.
"Change ruined this town. Bar I just came from, 3 of them sitting in there, biggest sin. 15 years ago, you couldn't have hired a nigger to go in there. You talk about change, and I say to you, go to hell."
I let it pass. Headline, Yankee half-breed knifed.
He waited, then said, "I'll tell you this, too. Problems we got ain't so much from niggers. They're more likely from northern jacks coming down here messing where it ain't their concern. Telling us how to live. That's what's got everybody riled, including niggers. You a reporter?"
"Just traveling through. Wanted to see what's changed in Selma.
Way we do business, what's changed. For the worse. But the thinking ain't. We live every man like he wants. Take Bonita here. She wants to get on the bar and strip and show off her business. Ain't no man gonna stop her."
"Would anybody stop a black man if he wanted a drink in here?"
"I'll be go to hell, shit. I've been all through this. I'm sick of it."
He turned away and talked to Bernita. She left to serve a table, and he looked at me again.
"Can't figure what you're getting at."
"Just want to see how things are. All I know is from books or TV."
"That is. That whole march was a TV stunt. Niggas knew what would happen here. That's why they came. Hardly none of them lived here. They knew the sheriff had himself a reputation. They picked him, not the town. Well, they got what they were looking for. I'm sick of going over and over it."
He went to the toilet. When he came back, he had another drink.
"Can't figure what you're driving at."
I didn't answer. He kept turning to the topic as if I were pushing him into it. He wanted to talk it through, and he blamed me for that.
"Those marchers rolled their own dice, and we got flammed. Of course, it ain't hard to flam George Wallace."
"What are you saying?"
"I'm telling you, sicking dogs and pounding the niggers was a lack of ignorance. We should have paid no mind. Then the cameras would have stayed in the bags. That's what ruined us, photographers and reporters. Like with the Klan. Some grand genie comes crawling out of his rotten stump, and there go the cameras and the tongue clucking over the poor South."
He stared into the dark mirror.
"Used to be everybody stayed in their place. That's what's got all mixed around. I'm sick of talking about it."
"Don't get the wrong idea," Bernita said. "Selma's a nice town. We got colors in City Hall and places. Only thing I don't like is people are two-faced. Friendly at first, then you see the truth."
Ray said, "Don't know what he's trying to get at. Hell, I got niggas working for me over at the dealership. I hire them, but they up and quit."
"What kind of work?"
"Washing cars."
"They ever get to sell a car?"
"You know anything? I'd lose every one of my customers."
"Looks like you've got each other by the balls. Somebody needs to let go." He leaned back on the stool.
"Well, well, well. Got a lot of advice, don't you now? You don't know a damn thing. Come in for a day and got the answers. No use explaining to you. Tell me, you talk with any niggers?
Not here. Not here. You got a picture in your brain all made up like a bed. Know all about it.